Functional anatomy. Knowledge of functional anatomy is critical to the success of any health and fitness trainer because movement stems from the application of force produced by the muscle on the attached bone. Having clear comprehension of the musculoskeletal structures and their function is fundamental to understanding human movement. So what we want to do is employ our knowledge of the body's structure and how they work in a coordinated manner. And this is going to allow the health and fitness professional to use appropriate decision-making criteria for individual exercise prescription. So we're going to go over bones to start, and then we're going to get into the muscles. So the composition of bone, the human skeletal system is uniquely designed to resist stress, providing shape and support to the body. The skeleton has a mineral component which provides rigidity, and a protein component that makes bone resistant to tension. The organic compounds of protein, mainly in the form of collagen fiber, represent 33% of the bone, while the mineral component represents the other 67%. There's about 1% magnesium, 1% sodium, 1% potassium, 10% carbonate, 33% collagen, 17% phosphate, and it's 37% calcium. The resilience of the bony tissue makes the body capable of managing force, while the connective tissues provide for the application of force. Together, the tissues function to systematically produce and control motor function. Okay, a couple terms as far as bone health is concerned is osteopenia, and this refers to bone mineral density, or BMD, that is lower than normal peak BMD, but not low enough to be classified as osteoporosis. Okay, so osteoporosis is irreversible decrease in the mineralized bony tissue. Okay, so inside a bone, you have the spongy bone, you have compact bone, you have the marrow cavity, and then you have the trabecula of spongy bone. Okay, so the spongy bone is, kind of porous, and it has a very spongy type of material. Compact bone is the outside, and then the inside is the marrow cavity. Okay, so bone growth. As far as the skeletal system, it begins as a cartilage structure and is replaced by bone through a maturation process, which is called ossification. So when you're born, you're basically cartilage, kind of like a shark. So increase in bone mass occur from the formation of new bone in the surface of existing bone tissue called oppositional growth. I can't even say it. I'm going to say appositional growth. During normal maturation, the bone increases in size and is remodeled by the removal and replacement of bone. Bone length is attributed to endochondral growth, where cartilage is ossified in the epiphyseal plate of long bones. As human age, new cartilage is formed to promote growth that eventually turns to bone. Vertical growth ceases when no further cartilage is formed and the present cartilage becomes ossified. In most humans, 90% of bone mass is reached by the age of 18. The integrity of the bone is often measured by mass and density. Bone mass represents the surface area of the bone, while the bone mineral density reflects the concentration of minerals within the bone. Other key terms, like I said, the appositional growth is the growth of by the addition of new layers on those previously formed, characteristic of tissue formed of rigid materials. Endochondrial growth is the process of bone formation whereby a cartilage model is replaced by bone. Epiphyseal plates, this is a transverse cartilage plate near the end of a child's bone responsible for growth in the length of the bone. Bone mass is the volume of bone in the body measured by mineral content. Bone mineral density is the mineral content in a given volume of bone used as a measure of bony health and in the diagnosis of osteoporosis. So starting at the skull, you have your cranium, your maxilla, which is your upper lip, and your mandible, which is your chin, your clavicle, which is, they call that your collarbone, Your sternum, which is the middle of your chest. Your humerus, which is your upper arm. Your ribs, which protect your lungs and protect your heart. Your radius, which is the outside portion of the lower arm. The ulna, which is the inside portion of the lower arm, if you're looking at the anatomical position. The carpals, those are your fingers or your thumb. Your metacarpals are the bones before your phalanges. So your carpals, metacarpals, and phalanges make up your hand. So the first bone of your finger is called your carpal, your second bone is your metacarpal, and then the last bone of your finger is called your phalanges. Your upper thigh bone is called your femur. Your kneecap is called the patella. The fibula is the outside floating bone, and then the tibia is your tougher, bigger, supportive bone on the lower limb. Your phalanges are the same on your feet. So your toes, the outer bone of your feet are your phalanges. Middle are middle tarsals, and your beginning are the tarsals. Looking at the spine, you have your cervical vertebrae, which are your first 7 vertebrae. Your scapula, which is the wing bone, I guess you can call it. Those make up your shoulder blade. Your thoracic vertebrae, which are the next 12 vertebrae. The lumbar vertebrae, which are the last 5 vertebrae. And then it goes your sacrum and coccyx, which are fused bones. Your hips or your pelvis is a bone, and then your calcaneus or your heel is also a bone. So those are the major bones of the body. Other key terms, important to note, joints. What are joints? Well, they're a point of articulation between two or more bones, especially such a connection that allows motion. So you have different types of joints. You have the plane joint, and this allows bones to slide past each other. Midcarpal and metatarsal joints are plane joints. Those are found in the hands and feet. A pivot joint allows rotation around an axis. Pivot joints are found in the neck and forearm. So supination and pronation. A hinge joint allows extension and retraction of an appendage. Hinge joints are found in the knees, elbows, fingers, and toes. A condyloid joint is similar to the ball and socket, but with less movement. The wrist is a condyloid joint. Okay. A ball and socket joint allows for radial movement in almost any direction. Ball and socket joints are found in the shoulder and hips. A saddle joint allows movement back and forth and up and down. The only saddle joint in the human body is the thumb. Other key terms, there are fibrous joints. This consists of two bones that are united by fibrous tissue and exhibit little or no movement. You have cartilaginous joints, which unite two bones by means of either hyaline cartilage or fibrocartilage. You have your synovial joints, which contain synovial fluid and allow for considerable movement between articulating bones. And all of those, most of the major joints are synovial joints. Hyaline cartilage, a tough, elastic, fibrous connective tissue found in various parts of the body, such as the joints, outer ear, and larynx. Fibrocartilage is cartilage that allows for greater movement capabilities due to its flexible nature. Articular discs, a plate of, or ring or fibrocartilage attached to the joint capsule and separating the articular surface of the bones. The joint capsule is a sac enclosing a joint formed by an outer fibrous membrane and an inner synovial membrane. And there's the periosteum. This is the dense fibrous membrane covering the surface of bones except at the joints and serving as an attachment for muscles and tendons. Other key terms, ligaments. These are tough fibrous bands of connective tissue that supports internal organs and holds bones together properly in joints. Tendons is a tough band of fibrous connective tissue that connects muscles to bones. Synovial membrane is a layer of connective tissue which lines the joint and produces synovial fluid. Bursa is a tiny fluid-filled sac that functions as a gliding surface to reduce friction between tissues of the body. Hypermobility is a term that describes joints that stretch further than normal. So there is the muscles that we're going to get into next. But first, we're going to just talk about how joints work. So joints move when internal forces or external forces are applied to the skeleton. Voluntary movements require muscles to contract in a coordinated manner to produce internal forces, which act on the bone. Muscle connects to bone by tendons, which extend from the musculotendinous junction at the muscle's end to the periosteum, a fibrous connective tissue which makes up the outer surface of the bone. The periosteum isolates the bone with surrounding tissues and encases a network of nerves and vessels which provide nutrients and participates in bone remodeling. Near joints, the periosteum becomes continuous with connective tissue to hold bones together and form the joint capsule. The fibers of the periosteum are also interwoven with the tendons that attach to the bone. The connective tissues are further secured to the bone by collagen fibers, which provide for an extremely strong attachment, so strong that an exertion of force beyond the tissue's strength will most often break a bone before snapping the collagen fibers at the bone surface. This tension is monitored by special neuronal cells, Golgi tendon organs, which send reflective signals to the spinal cord. These signals are part of a protective mechanism involving inhibitory signals to the contracting muscle when the tension on the bone reaches a critical threshold prior to damage. Okay. On the other end of the tendon, connective tissue is structured in a way that produces and manages efficient force development. The muscle anatomy that causes movement is arranged to serve several purposes. The obvious first role of skeletal muscle is to pull on the tendons attached to the skeletal for movement. The skeletal muscles also must produce tension to maintain posture and sustain body positions. In addition, skeletal muscles serve to support soft tissues, such as the visceral organs, guard entrances and exits, including the digestive and urinary tracts for swallowing, defecation, and urination, as well as the assistance and maintenance of body temperature by releasing heat. Okay. Skeletal muscles are organized into several layers. The outer layer is the muscle fascia, which is a fibrous connective tissue that separates individual muscles, and in some cases, muscle groups, providing shape to the arranged fibers it contains and maintaining intramuscular tension. Just beneath the fascia is the epinesium, which is a dense collection of collagen fibers covering the entire surface of the muscle. Inside the epinesium lies bundles of fibers enclosed by the perinesium. Each bundle is called fasciolus, which contains packages of muscle fibers called myofibrils. Okay. Myofibrils are made up of long cylinder-like muscle fibers, muscle cells. The individual muscle fibers are encompassed by endonesium. The muscle fibers are further encased by sarcolemma, a delicate external lamina of reticular fibers which serve as an extension of the muscle fiber for connective purposes. The individual muscle fibers themselves can be further broken down to their constituent parts called myofibrils. The myofibrils are comprised of proteins called myofilaments, which set the actions of the muscles into motion. The thick myofilaments are myosin, and the thin filaments are actin. Together, actin and myosin are arranged in functional sequence along the myofibril and are used to create tension inside the muscle tissue. So this is interesting because it just seems like there's just so much stuff going on. It's all made out of the same thing, which is connective tissue. If you've ever heard of bioflow or functional arranged systems, you would understand that basically our whole body is just, I mean, you take the skin off a human body and you can't really tell what is a tendon and what is a bone and what is a ligament. It all just kind of runs together. Okay. You have to dye these, people that, are used in laboratories, and you have to look at the muscles and you have to blow them up with sodium, and you have to do so much stuff to make it look like these diagrams that we see. So it's really important that you understand that muscles, bones, tendons, it all just kind of just meshes together in some way called bioflow. So there are positional lines and movement planes that are important, because a lot of people say, you know, you need to be in the anatomical position. And this is the standard reference position for the body when describing locations, positions, and movements of limbs or other anatomical structures. Anatomical position is assumed when the body is standing with erect posture, facing forward with both feet aligned parallel and the toes forward. The arms and hands hanging below the shoulders at the side with the elbows and fingers extended, palms facing forward. From this reference position, spatial and directional terms can be easily applied. So positional lines and movement planes, spatial term comprehension and accuracy can be further enhanced by the defined lines of origin along the anatomical position. These lines correspond with the planes of movement, the line that dissects the body down the center, splitting it into side by side halves, is called the midline, which lies along the sagittal plane. When that line is shifted over to a line with the crease of the arm, it is referred to the anterior axillary line. If the line dissects the body into front and back halves, it would be called the mid-axillary line, which runs along the frontal plane. The last plane is called the transverse plane. It runs side to side and anterior to posterior, dissecting the body into superior top and inferior bottom parts. Sometimes the word cardinal or cross is attached to planes to identify the center gravity of the body. Planes will be further reviewed in a movement terminology section. So if something on the body is closer to the midline, it's called medial. If there's something on the body that is closer to the outside, it is called lateral, okay? So for instance, if something is in front of the body or the body segment moves forward, the space descriptor for the movement or location would be anterior. If the location of space is behind the body, it's going to be posterior, okay? Anterior is also synonymous with ventral, and posterior is synonymous with dorsal. Spatial terms can be used directional movements in case with medial, internal, and inward rotation, or lateral, external, and outward rotation. When applied to rotation, these terms have synonymous relationship. Medial refers to the direction or location toward or closer to the midline, while lateral refers to position or movement away from the body. Okay. When locating a point of direction along a limb, the term proximal and distal are used. Proximal refers to direction or location close to where the limb attaches to the body, where distal refers to the point toward the end of the limb or location farthest away from the limb's attachment site. When the limbs are viewed from a particular side, they are often referenced by the terms ipsilateral, same side, and contralateral, opposite side, rather than left or right. The terms superficial and deep also refer to locations on or within the body. Location descriptors refer to positions relative to the exterior surface of the body. Superficial layers are of tissue, for instance, lie just below the skin, while deep tissues are more internally located in reference to the skin layer. As far as the axes that correspond with the sagittal plane is the transverse axis. The frontal or coronal plane dissects the body into front and back. It runs side to side, superior to inferior, top to bottom. The respective plane of movement is the anterior-posterior axis. The transverse plane runs perpendicular to the sagittal plane, splitting the body into top and bottom. And the axis of rotation for the transverse plane is called the longitudinal axis. Okay. With the planes and axes of rotation defined, the application movement can be described accurately. The movements can be categorized by the plane that they occur in. Movements around the transverse axis, sagittal plane, include flexion, extension, hyperextension, plantar flexion, and dorsal flexion. The joint movement that occur around the anterior-posterior axis, frontal plane, include abduction, adduction, lateral flexion, left and right, inversion, eversion, radial deviation, and ulnar deviation. The longitudinal axis, transverse plane, perpetuates different types of rotational movements. These include internal and external rotation, supination, pronation, horizontal abduction, and horizontal adduction. Okay? So your spinal cord can flex and extend and hyperextend. Your trunk can laterally flex to the right or left. Your trunk can rotate to the left or right. Your neck can rotate to the left or right. Your neck can flex, extend, and hyperextend. Your neck can laterally flex to the left or the right. Your shoulder can abduct or adduct. Your shoulder can also flex, extend, or hyperextend. Your shoulder can externally rotate and internally rotate. It can also horizontal abduct and horizontal adduct itself. Okay. Your lower forearms can pronate and supinate. Your elbow can flex and extend. Your wrist can radial deviate or ulnar deviate. Your hip can external or internally rotate, flex, extend, hyperextend, abduct or adduct. Your knee and ankle, your ankle can do inversion, which is going inside, and eversion out. Plantar flexion, pointing the toe down. Dorsiflexion, flexing the toe up. And then you have your flexion extension of the knee. Okay. So those are some functional anatomy terms for the entire body. Talked about the spine, cervical 1 to 7, thoracic T 1 to 12, lumbar 1 to 5, and your sacrum and your coccyx. Okay. If the forward curvature is exaggerated in an undesirable manner of your lower back, this is called lordosis. The curvature of the thoracic spine, thoracic and sacral spine, is convex or kyphotic. When the thoracic spine experiences an exaggerated curvature, it is referred to being in a state of kyphosis. So your lower back can go into lordosis, or it can stay lordotic, or it can be go into kyphosis, or it can be kyphotic. You want it to be kyphotic, and you don't want it to go into kyphosis. You want it to be lordotic, you don't want it to go into lordosis. Okay. Your coccygeal bone is 4 or 5 fused vertebrae, and your let's see if I can find that. Your sacral bone is 5 fused vertebrae. Okay. When the term neutral spine is applied, it refers to the state of functional curvature seen in an erect posture. So neutral spine means that your chest is up, your back is straight. Okay. You do have spinal curves, like we talked about, kyphotic and lordotic. If they're irregular, it's kyphosis for upper back and lordosis for lower back. As far as other key terms, so lordosis would be technically an anterior curvature of the spine, creating a sway back appearance, and kyphosis is an abnormal convex outward curvature of the upper portion of the spinal column, sometimes called humpback or hunchback. Neutral spine, a spinal position that retains the 3 natural curves, a small lordotic curve at the base of the neck, a small kyphotic curve at the middle back, and a small lordotic curve in the low back. Okay. Intervertebral discs are fibrocartilaginous discs serving as cushion between the vertebrae of the spinal column. Okay. Looking at a cross section of the spinal and trunk musculature, on the outsides of the deeper layers of the abdomen, you have your transverse abdominis. Going more superficial, you have your internal oblique, then your external oblique, and then all the way superficial would be your rectus abdominis. Starting deep, you have your transverse abdominis, then you have your internal oblique, external oblique, all the way superficially to your rectus abdominis. So deeper you go, more you get into the inner layers of the muscle. As far as your upper neck, you have a semispinalis capitis. I think you say it, semispinalis capitis, at the base of the back of the neck. You have your spinalis thoracics in the middle of the upper back, very deep muscle. You have your longissimus thoracis, that is in the middle outward of the back. You have your iliocolastus lumborum, that is at the lower outer back. And these are deep muscles. You have your multifidus. This is in a deep portion of the low back. You have your quadratus lumborum, which is the outside of the lower back. And you have your erector spinae, which runs up your back, starting at the lower back. Your erector spinae are your major superficial muscles, whereas your quadratus lumborum, your multifidus, semispinalis capitis are a little bit deeper. So your rectus abdominis, that is responsible for trunk flexion. You can do an ab curl up, external obliques. These flex and rotate the vertebral column, diagonal chop. Internal oblique flexes and rotates vertebral column, cable torso twist. Transverse abdominis, this movement function is compresses the abdomen or a draw in. Erector spinae group extends vertebral column, good mornings. Back quadratus lumborum, abducts vertebral column, and this is responsible for lateral flexion. Your hips can be neutral, posterior, or anterior, and they can have pelvic tilts. If it's if the tilt is going up and down, it's neutral. If the tilt is going back, it is a posterior pelvic tilt, and if the tilt is going forward, it is an anterior pelvic tilt. Okay, so basically, if your hips go back, that's an anterior pelvic tilt. When you squeeze your glutes and engage your glutes, then you get more of a posterior pelvic tilt. So what I like to say is, when you hinge at the hips, that's an anterior pelvic tilt. When I say tuck your pelvis in, that's more of a posterior pelvic tilt. As far as your shoulder, the glenohumeral joint is a ball and socket joint which allows for the most movement of any joint. As previously mentioned, the shallow glenoid fossa allows for substantial movement capabilities by the humerus. In the hip, these same movements are more closely limited by the articulating surface of the joint, causing it to be more stable. For instance, abduction at the shoulder joint far surpasses the 45 degree attainable at the hip. In humeral or shoulder flexion, the arm can be raised far above the shoulder when the hand is held in neutral position. Additionally, the joint allows for the movement in all planes, including flexion extension, hyperextension, abduction, adduction, horizontal adduction, horizontal abduction, internal and external rotation, and circumduction. The vast movement capabilities decrease the stability due to the reduced contact area. To counteract the lack of stability, the body uses three sets of ligaments and four muscles, which collectively make up the rotator cuff. The rotator cuff, which is comprised of the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis, also serve to assist movement at the shoulder. The teres minor and infraspinatus extend and externally rotate the humerus. The supraspinatus abducts the humerus to 30 degrees, while the subscapularis extends and medially rotates the humerus. So you got a lot going on in that shoulder area there, or what some people may also term that as the rotator cuff. Okay, so you have your deltoids, which are located on top of your shoulder, or you have three of those, your anterior, posterior, and medial. That's not your your rotator cuff. This is your actual, the muscles on top of the superficial muscles of the shoulder, so not located on the scapula. You have your pectoralis major, your chest muscle. You have your latissimus dorsi, which is your back, which is responsible for adduction. We talked about the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor. Those are all part of your rotator cuff along with your subscapularis. And you have your teres major, which is below your teres minor and below your infraspinatus. But that is not in the same ballpark as the rotator cuff. So that actually does something else. Your deltoids, they horizontally abduct, flex, extend, and rotate the humerus. For example, side raise. The latissimus dorsi, they adduct, medially rotate and extend the humerus. Example would be a pull-up. The pectoralis major, it horizontally adducts, flexes, extends, and medially rotates the humerus. Bench press. Your teres major adducts, extends, and medially rotates root humerus. That's a single arm row or a pull down. Coracobrachialis adducts and flexes the humerus, front raise. Infraspinatus extends and externally rotates the humerus. That would be an external band rotation. Subscapularis, that extends and internally rotates the humerus. Internal band rotation. So the infraspinatus is geared toward external rotation, and your subscapularis is internal rotation. And your subscapularis, below the scapula, And then you have your supraspinatus, or I mean you have your infraspinatus, which is below the scapula. And this is referring to the scapular spine of the scapula, and so it's actually that's why it said infraspinatus. It's actually below the spine of the scapula, so that's what that means. Okay. As far as the supraspinatus, which is above the spine of the scapula, that abducts the humerus. Empty can raise would be one of those. Teres minor, that adducts and externally rotates the humerus. Example would be an external band rotation. Okay. Your trapezius is muscles behind your neck, and they help you shrug. And they elevate, depress, rotate, and fixes the scapula, and extends the neck. Your rhomboid major, which is located in the middle of the upper back, that retracts, rotates, and fixes the scapula like a seated row. Your pectoralis minor, that depresses the scapula, so like a chest fly would work that. The levator scapula, that elevates and retracts scapula, for example, abducts the neck or a high rope. Your levator scapula is on the lateral portion of the neck, right below the skin. Your humerus is the upper bone. The scapula is your wing bone. Your serratus anterior is located on the upper front and back of the rib cage. So you have your serratus anterior and your serratus posterior. Pectoralis minor is above the serratus anterior on the anterior portion of the rib cage. And you have your clavicle, which we talked about, which is your collarbone or right under your chin to the either side. Your biceps brachii is located on top of the humerus along with your brachialis. And your triceps brachii is the back of your arm. Okay. Biceps brachii flex the arm. Example would be a bicep curl. Your brachialis flexes the arm as well. You get more of this with a reverse grip curl, pronating it. Brachioradialis, flexing arm like a hammer curl or neutral grip. Triceps brachii, any type of arm extension, cable pushdown. Flexor carpal radialis, this flexes and abducts the wrists. It's like a wrist curl. Flexor carpi ulnaris, flexes and adducts the wrist curls. Extensor carpio radialis, extends and abducts wrist. Reverse wrist curls, and extensor carpial ulnaris extends and adducts wrists, and this would be a reverse wrist curl. So you have your muscles on you have some muscles in your forearms, on the bottom of your forearms or the anterior portion of your forearms, you have your extensor, you have your flexor carpial ulnaris and your flexor carpial radialis, and on the anterior portion, you have your extensors, carpi radialis and carpi ulnaris. Okay, as far as your hip, you have your gluteus medius, which is located on the upper side of the hip. You have your gluteus maximus, which is your butt cheek, and your tensio fascia lata, which is on the outside anterior portion of the hip. You have your gluteus minimus, which is on the inside of the actual hip bone with your piriformis, and your psoas major. What that does, that flexes the hip. Your iliacus, this flexes the hip and medially rotates the hip. Diagonal knee raise. Gluteus maximus extends, adducts, and laterally rotates the thigh or squat. Gluteus medius abducts and medially rotates thigh, lateral squat. Gluteus minimus abducts and medially rotates thigh, lateral squat. Tensor fascia lata abducts and medially rotates thigh, supine leg abduction. Piriformis laterally rotates and abducts thigh, rotational step outs, and quadratus femoris. This laterally rotates and abducts the thigh, example rotational step outs. Okay. Psoas Major is located kind of like right in your right below your midsection or your belly, the inside, attached to your spinal cord and goes into your hip. So lower portion of the spinal cord into the hip. Your rectus femoris is the big muscle on the front of your upper thigh, and then you have your vastus lateralis, which is on the outer portion of your thigh. Your vastus medius was the inside of your thigh, and your vastus intermedius, which is in between those. You have your sartorius, which wraps around from the outside to the inside of the knee. Your pectinus, which is a little bit closer to the inside of the thigh, or your adductors. And you have three muscles that make up your adductors, which are your adductor brevis, adductor longus, and adductor magnus. Your calf or the back of your lower limb is has the semimembranosus, or your biceps femoris, sorry, your hamstring. So your hamstring muscles are made have three muscles, and those are your semitendinosus, which is on the medial portion, your semimembranosus, which is below the semitendinosus and kind of under it, and then you have your biceps femoris, which is on the lateral portion of your hamstring. So your rectus femoris, that extends the leg, it flexes the thigh, example, a front squat. Vastus lateralis extends a leg like a lunge. Vastus intermedius extends a leg like a leg press. Vastus medialis extends leg extension. Sartorius flexes hip and leg, rotates leg medially and thigh laterally, lateral step up. Biceps femoris extends thigh, hip flexes and laterally rotates leg, Romanian deadlift. Semitendinosus extends thigh, hip flexes and medially rotates leg, supine leg curl. Semimembranosus extends thigh, hip flexes and medially rotates leg, standing leg curl. Adductor brevis flexes and laterally rotates thigh, lateral lunge. Adductor longus, adducts, flexes and laterally rotates thigh, example step ups. Adductor magnus, adducts, extends and laterally rotates thigh, seated adduction. And pectinus, adducts and flexes thigh, cable adduction. Okay. Lastly, we'll go into the lower leg. Looking at the front, you have your tibialis anterior, right in front of the tibia, and you have your behind the on the side of your leg, you have on the outside of your leg, you have your peroneus longus and your peroneus brevis, looking at the with a lateral view. And then in your posterior, you have your soleus and gastrocnemius. Your gastrocnemius is responsible for plantar flexion and flexes leg, standing calf raise. Soleus is responsible for plantar flexing the foot, seated calf raise. So notice that you get more gastrocnemius when you do a standing calf raise and more soleus when you do a seated calf raise. Tibialis anterior, dorsiflex and inverts foot, like a toe raise. Peroneus tarsus, dorsiflexes and everts foot, toe raise. Peroneus brevis, plantar flexes and everts foot, calf raise. And peroneus longus, plantar flexes and everts foot or calf raise. So that's going to be functional anatomy. Going through some information here, looking at the advanced concepts of personal training, and I hope you got some good information here, talking about bones, joints, muscle, spatial terms, spine and pelvis, and muscle identification. Next lecture, we'll go into biomechanics. Look forward to seeing you then. Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.